Relationship Podcast with your host, certified life coach, Chris Rich. If you're having trouble navigating your mixed faith relationships, struggling to connect with your people, or having specific challenges, you are in the right place, my friend. Episode 83, special guest, Krista St. Germain. Hello, my beautiful friends. I hope your Christmas was amazing and that you're getting some downtime to enjoy your holiday break. It can be busy cleaning up the clutter, making returns, and creating space for all of those new gifts. Speaking of gifts, I have a special guest joining us today, and she is truly a gift. Krista St. Germain is an expert on grief. Grief is a topic that comes up when a loved one leaves the church. And it's my hope that this discussion will help you have a better idea on how grief works. Well, Krista, I am so honored to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's totally my pleasure to be here. I have to say, some people have like this podcasting voice that's totally inauthentic. You sound on your podcast exactly as lovely and authentic as you sound in real life.
Oh,
which is like kind of refreshing.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I'll try to keep that same voice.
Okay.
No pressure now, right?
It's not your fake podcast voice. It's like your actual Chris voice.
Oh, well, I'll try to keep that actual Chris voice then.
Okay.
Love it. Well, Krista, I have so much respect for you and you've helped me understand grief so much. I would love for you to just introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about you and why are you so passionate about helping people with grief? Tell us your story.
Yeah, thank you for that. First, I'll say I always love when anyone wants to talk about grief because so many people aren't willing. So thank you for like having that conversation. So I came into this work not on purpose at all, actually. I was 40 and I was on my second marriage. First one kind of went down in flames. Second one felt like the redemption story, like proof that true love is possible and you can be treated the way you want to be treated. And it was just, I was in a really magical place. That's how it felt to me. And he and I were coming back from a trip that we had taken and we had driven separately. And I had a flat tire in my car. We were almost home. We were on the interstate just north of the city that I live in. And I had a flat tire. I pulled over and he pulled up behind me. And I said, you know, let's call AAA because we pay for AAA. Let's call. No, baby, I'll just change the tire. We'll get home faster. I just want to get home and cuddle and like, I'll just change the tire. So he's digging into the back of my trunk, trying to get access to the spare tire. And I'm standing on the side of the road, texting my daughter who was 12 at the time. My daughter was 12. My son was 9. And I was texting her to tell her we'd be late. And it was like 5:30 on a Sunday, a driver that just really didn't see us. We had our hazard lights on, but he didn't see us. We also found out later that he had meth and alcohol in his system, but he crashed right in between the back of Hugo's car and trapped him in between his car and my car. And it just felt like in that 24-hour period, I went from, well, life is amazing, my best days are in front of me, to just the rug being completely ripped out from under me. And what I very quickly learned, even though I had a great therapist, thankfully, what I very quickly learned is that what I thought I knew about grief wasn't actually very helpful. In fact, most of it was outdated. It wasn't useful to me. It was actually kind of harmful. And fast forward, having to do my own research and figure out what I know now, I don't want other people to have the same experience that I had. I don't want them to be falling for the same outdated information and myths about grief that I did. I want to give people tools and help them have easier experiences of grief because we're all going to have grief at some point in life,
yeah.
You know? And so that's why I do what I do. So specifically, I host a podcast called The Widowed Mom Podcast, and I work with widowed moms. But whenever I can make someone's grief experience easier, that's what I want to do. So
well,
here we are.
I just want to give you a hug through the screen. That is, I can't imagine how hard and how amazing it is that you are using that experience to go and help other people with their hard things. I'm so sorry. This is probably really inappropriate to tell you this right now. I'm in my office and I'm on the second floor. And I just looked out the window and someone just walked past my window because they're cleaning my gutters.
Oh, And like, I'm walk past your window on the second floor. That doesn't add up.
So that's fun. That's a fun thing to have. So I'm like listening to your story, and there is a man that just walked past. So,
well, I am glad you are dressed, Chris.
Me too. That is a well, that was a very I was not expecting that. So okay. So let me focus back on what's going on our podcast right now. Okay, so we're focused on getting back to talking about grief. Yeah. So I'm curious. There, I think we have so many different ideas of what grief is and what it should be. And you mentioned that there are these myths. Let's tackle those. What are the myths around grief? Let's look at that.
Yeah. So in addition to the coaching that I do, I also have gotten into doing educational work for companies and organizations. And I'll go in and I'll talk about grief and kind of help their teams better understand grief. And one of the questions I always ask is, how many of you have heard of the five stages? And when I ask that question, pretty much every hand will go up. And then when I ask, how many of you have heard of any other theory besides the five stages? Invariably, no hands. Right? Nobody has heard of anything beyond the five stages of grief. And I think that is the number one myth that if I can bust for people, will help them, right? Then this is what I knew when I came into grief. The five stages of grief was actually created, first of all, in 1969, which, not to date myself, but before I was born. Okay.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth noting that while in its time, it was really important work because nobody else was having these conversations. Nobody was really talking about it in the way that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did. But that work was actually anecdotal, first of all. And secondly, it was based on hospice patients. It wasn't really based on what does someone who experiences a loss go through. It was based on what does someone who's coming to terms with their own mortality, a terminal diagnosis, go through. And so she came up with these five stages. So denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And she wrote a book called On Death and Dying. And then later she wrote a book called On Grief and Grieving. And she took those five stages from the death experience and then applied them to the grief experience. So again, important in its time. Lots of credit to her for that work. And also, it seems like that's the only theory that our popular culture picked up. Mm-hmm. Whenever I have conversations with even friends of mine who are physicians or in, you know, licensed medical professionals, right? That's what they learned in school too, was five stages of grief. So because that's the only theory that we know of in our culture, and that's the only theory that we are prepared for, then it can be really challenging. First of all, there's lots of other theories about grief, but again, nobody's talking about them, to get into a grief experience and compare your experience to what you think it's supposed to look like. Meanwhile, your experience doesn't look like that at all necessarily. Yeah. And so I think the thing that drives me the most crazy is that that's all we talk about. I was even back in August when the Maui fires happened in Lahaina, mm-hmm. I remember watching TV and I saw a reporter who was live on the scene. And that's what he said. I'm live on the scene here in Lahaina and I'm seeing the five stages of grief unfold in front of me, right? It's in all the movies. It's everywhere. And grief is just not that neat and tidy. It's not that linear. It doesn't actually end. It's acceptance is not a magical place that we reach and poof, you know, we're not grieving anymore, right? It's very messy. It's very nonlinear. It's super unique. It includes all feelings. I like to think of grief as the natural human response to loss, right? So we perceive a loss and we have a natural human response to it. And that natural human response will evolve over time, right? But it includes all the thoughts, all the feelings, all the behaviors as a result of our response to that loss. And of course, it's so much more than bereavement, right? Which is why we get to talk about it in the context of what happens if someone leaves the church, right? And
yeah.
It is a loss in that you thought it was going to go one way, both now in your current life and also in your eternal one. And now it's not. And that feels like a loss, right? But
yeah.
Anyway, so I could probably talk about lots of things that we hear that set us up for more suffering than is necessary. But gosh, five stages is just such a big one.
That, and you know, it's another thing that I hear a lot of times when someone has a partner that has left the church, they say they're still in this angry phase. You hear that mm-hmm. all the time. And yeah, I think that can be, it can be damaging because you have this expectation that, okay, and then it's going to move on to this one. It's like you said, it's not that neat and tidy. So,
yeah. And then also it has us asking questions like, well, am I angry enough? Or am I too angry? Right. Or like, and then we expect, okay, anger's going to end and then bargaining is going to start, or, you know,
yeah.
Yeah. It's just, that's not, yes. Many of us do experience anger and grief. And also we experience so much more than that.
Yeah. Well, so I'm curious with this, you know, well, just so you understand a little bit of my story. When I was a teenager, my brother died by suicide when I was 14, and he had just come home from a mission for our church. He was 21. And my mom died when I was 25. And then when my husband left the church, this was like I knew what grief was like. I had I thought I did. And I had definitely had experienced a lot of those emotions just with what had happened. And this was a whole new package for me, because it was like, you know, this idea that I know that in my belief system, that I'm going to see my brother again, that I'm going to see my mom again. And when you're in this, it's like, and it's so confusing, because it's like, so my person is here. They're sleeping in my bed. They're in my home. And wondering, like, what does that look like? So it's, yeah, I would love for you to kind of talk about why that is. Why is that such a big thing?
So one thing that came up as you were telling me that story is that just because we know grief doesn't mean we know grief, right? We know what it's like to have a type of grief or a grief experience, but grief experiences can vary wildly from one to another. So that can be really surprising when we expect that it's going to feel the same or be the same or similar even to what it was before. And maybe it will, and maybe it won't. So nothing has gone wrong there. But again, if we're expecting it to be something that it doesn't turn out to be, that can be challenging. How do we support ourselves in that? Also, though, there are some names for what that grief experience is like, right? So a couple that come to mind, well, actually three we could talk about. Anticipatory grief. One of them, right? Anticipatory grief is when we are grieving something that hasn't quite happened yet, but we know it's coming, right? So that's what came to mind as you were describing, I'm living with this person, they're still here. And also I'm anticipating that in the future, when I expected them to be there, where I think I'm going to meet my brother and I know I'm going to meet my mother, now is this person going to be with me? I'm anticipating the grief of that, even though it hasn't happened yet. Yeah. Also, potentially cumulative grief, right? Where we have one grief and then another and then another. And, you know, they can kind of build up, essentially. Also, I imagine that you have, because it, you know, you probably have a lot of friends in your circle that are, you know, in your ward and like close to you, and they're, you know, they have similar faith traditions that you have, there are some people that get it, but then there are probably a bunch of other people who don't really, because maybe they aren't in your faith, right? And so then that experience is kind of what we would call disenfranchised grief, where they're like, what's the big deal again? Like, he's still here. You're still with him.
Yeah.
Right. It's in based on their norms and their beliefs and their understandings of the way that the world works for them. Your loss doesn't feel like a loss to them. And so they don't really get it and know how to support you. So
and I think that's a big thing, even with myself and my clients that I work with. A lot of times it is our spouse that has that, where we experience that disenfranchised grief. Because it's like, what is your deal? Why are you so upset? I'm still here.
I'm still married. I'm still here. I'm still with you.
I'm still the same person. We hear that all the time. So I think that's exactly where that would fit in. That makes sense. Definitely comes up.
Yeah. But we want to be really gentle, right? And remind ourselves that they might not understand our grief, but and other people outside of our relationship might not understand our grief, but that doesn't make it wrong or invalid. Right? It feels like a loss to us.
Yeah.
Therefore, grief. And that's not wrong.
So what if someone was in that situation, what do you recommend for them to, how do you support yourself in that grief, even when the other people don't get it?
You know what I really wish is that I could just write a little manual and that I could just give it to people and everybody could follow it. And it could be just like here. I think that's why we're so attracted to the five stages, because we want that the security that a process offers.
Yeah.
And I get that because I wanted it too, but also it's just not the way it is. It's not the way grief is for most of us. So some things that I can say that do help. One is letting ourselves feel how we actually feel. And the more I've gotten into coaching and the more I've talked about it with people, the more I have really realized that we might think we're good at letting ourselves feel how we feel, but most of us really aren't. Most of us are trying to talk ourselves out of how we feel. We're placing judgment on ourselves for how we feel. We're making how we feel mean something about us that it doesn't have to mean, right? We're having all of these stories about what how we feel means, and we're telling ourselves that we should feel something other than we feel. And I think that just muddies up the experience and makes it harder. It's already hard. And then because of our stories about it, we make it harder. So if we could just get in the habit of letting ourselves feel how we feel without making it mean that we're doing something wrong or that something should be different, that would be a tremendous step in a powerful direction, right? We could reduce so much suffering. We're not going to get rid of the pain, but we could reduce the suffering that we kind of accidentally add on top of it.
And, you know, it's interesting, just as you were sharing your story, I noticed myself thinking like, oh my word, I can't even believe I'm having this. My experience is so different than yours. And, and we compare our atrocities and think there's like a certain, almost like we have a ranking system or something, like it's appropriate for Krista to feel this grief, but not as much for me. We have this idea of what is, we definitely compare our grief to other people.
And I'm all for comparison if we use it in ways that are supportive. So if we say, okay, well, she survived this, and so then I probably can too.
Yeah.
Right. Then there can be a lot of value in that. But how we often use it is, well, mine is worse or less than, as opposed to, you know, the grief in me sees the grief in you.
Mm.
Right. We don't use it as ways to connect. We use it as ways to disconnect.
I love that. The grief in me sees the grief in you. Yeah. It's a hard experience. This whole being a human, it's hard. It's a kick in the pants sometimes.
Sometimes perpetually.
Yes. Over and over again. Yeah. So I would love for you to share like when that grief comes up, give us some ideas on how to allow that grief. They've heard me before, but I would love your take on it.
Yeah. I have lots of tools that I like. Some of my favorites. So I'm a huge proponent of tapping. I don't know if you talked about tapping on your podcast or not, but
I haven't.
Anything that can create safety in the nervous system, right? Because sometimes our body, even though we're physically safe, we're not actually in danger. Our nervous system is responding like we are, right?
Yeah.
And when that's happening, it's not really something we can think ourselves out of. We usually don't even have access to the part of our brain that allows for, you know, executive level thinking and functioning. So we have to have a way, or we do better when we do have a way, of helping our body understand that we actually are safe. so that we can allow a feeling. And so tapping is just a way that you can use acupressure points on your body to reduce stress, to lessen cortisol. It's literally like an off switch for your body's stress response. It tells your, you know, sympathetic nervous system that, hey, you don't need to be on right now. We can get back to rest and digest. So I love tapping. Something even as simple as putting your hand on your heart. This is what I teach people when I call it a grief grenade. You know, those moments where it sneaks up on you and you're happy, happy, unaware. And then all of a sudden something happens and it catches you off guard and you feel this kind of intense emotional experience. I call it a grief grenade. And so just putting your hand on your heart, which is a way of telling your body that you're safe, right? Assuring yourself, and then taking a couple of deep breaths, right? And just reminding yourself, this is just a grief grenade, right? Like, I can handle this. Those ways help. And then probably the most exacting process that I tend to teach for how to feel a feeling is called NOW. I like acronyms. Mm-hmm. So I made one up that helped me remember it and helped other people remember it, which is name, open, witness. And so essentially what we do is name the emotion, give it a name. It doesn't have to be exact, right? If you're not sure if it's anger or frustration, it doesn't matter. Just pick one, right? But this is anger. And then open up to it, which is counterintuitive to what most of us were taught to do. And it requires practice, right? But open up to it. So literally you can say out loud, I give you permission to be here. Right? It's like you're getting in a car and you're giving it permission to come with you on the trip. You're not giving it permission to drive, but you're giving it permission to be with you in the car. Right.
Yeah.
And that opening process can sometimes be very physical too. Right. So if you notice yourself wanting to pull forward and kind of go inward or like fetal, then the opening can be bringing your shoulders back and opening up your chest and inhaling, right? Doing when your natural inclination is to get away from or avoid, the opening process is doing what we can do to do the opposite of that, to actually give it permission to be there, open up to it so that it will flow through us, right? Just like we wouldn't clamp down on a labor pain and tell ourselves the labor pain shouldn't be there. We don't want to clamp down on an emotion and tell ourselves the emotion shouldn't be there either. We give it permission. So we name it, we open up to it. And then the witnessing part is just where we actually, instead of getting caught up in the story of what's happening and continuing to feed off of that story, right? So if we're feeling angry, then that would look like just finding more things to be angry about and then kind of justifying our anger, or, you know, maybe we're behaving in angry ways, we're taking angry actions. But instead of doing that, we actually get out of our thinking brain and we go into our body and we watch what happens. We witness, right? So where is that feeling being felt? What is that experience of feeling that feeling like for me? I tend to notice a ton of emotions in my throat, like probably the majority of emotions for me in my throat. So, you know, I'm just noticing, what is it like? What is it? Does it have a texture? Does it have a temperature? Does it have a rhythm, a speed? Does it remind me of something? Is it like a brick? Is it like a bowling ball? Does it make me want to do anything? I'm just witnessing my own experience and watching it dissipate. You know, have you ever seen the movie Inside Out?
Yes. Love that movie.
Pixar? Yeah. It was on my mind this morning. So, you know, that scene, listeners, if you have not seen Pixar Inside Out, you must go watch it
tonight.
And a sequel is coming. So that scene where, so the characters, right, are all emotions in this little girl's head, basically body. And Joy is kind of in charge and she does not really know what to do with sadness, right? Like she's constantly trying to like put her in the corner and like keep her from damaging things. And she just feels like sadness is a problem and she doesn't really know how to deal with sadness. And at one point, sadness is kind, I mean, she's kind of a mess, right? And Joy's like, I don't know what to do with her. Yeah. And then at that same moment, do you remember this when Bing Bong comes? Bing Bong, the imaginary friend, he like sits next to sadness and just talks to her about what it's like to be sad and why she's sad. He witnesses her sadness.
Yeah.
And in seconds, she's like wiping her tears and she's over it, right? And I don't say over it as though it was ever a problem in the first place, but it was a transitory experience. And because he witnessed it, then it flowed through. And so that's what we're trying to do, right? Is be our own witness So what needs to happen and what our body knows how to do will happen because we're not interfering with it anymore. We're just letting it happen. And then, you know, a couple of minutes and it's gone. So name, open, witness.
Love that. And I love, love, love the grief grenade. I've shared that with I heard you share that once. And there's mm-hmm. so many times where in mixed faith relationships where maybe you see, like, you look at your wedding photo in front of the temple, or you're sitting in church and you see someone scratching their partner's back. And yeah. it's just like, those times where I think they come up a lot. And just also to just recognize, like, oh yeah, that was a grief grenade.
Yeah.
That, of course it makes sense. Of course I'm going to feel this when it's normal to have these
totally
times come up.
Normal. Yeah. And I also like making sure people understand the term secondary loss, because I wish I had understood that. I wish I had understood what secondary loss was. So the primary loss is what we actually lost, right? The initial. So in my case, my husband. So in your listener's case, it would be that they said they were leaving the church or that they left the church, right? That's the primary loss. Then the secondary losses, these are the death by 1,000 paper cuts. These are the things that just keep coming that we can't even necessarily predict because they haven't happened yet, right? These are the things that happen, the losses that we feel because of the primary loss, right? That just keep happening. So those are those moments where you see somebody with their partner and you feel the feeling of that. Or, you know, I mean, I don't even, there could just be so many that just keep coming. And if we have bought into grief ends and time heals, then when those secondary losses, which are very normal, when those losses are felt, we can mistakenly make ourselves wrong, right? Well, I was doing so good and now I'm slipping backwards, or I must have done something wrong, or I'm not very good at this, or I should be further along than where I am. When the reality is, no, that's just secondary loss. That's how grief works. We didn't do anything wrong. It's just, there are more losses. So of course we're going to have responses to them. That's not wrong and it's not backward.
I think that's one thing that people ask me all the time, Chris, when does it stop? Does the grief ever end? Mm-hmm. And I think my favorite way of describing it is like with the weather Doppler, that you may have you may be experiencing some grief, just like a thunderstorm, and it crosses the radar. And you know, that storm passes and then you've got sunshine and blue skies. But then it doesn't mean that you're never going to have a thunderstorm again. Anytime we have a circumstance that we have thoughts about, we are going to experience that grief again. Yeah. So it's kind of like asking, will it ever rain again? Yes, it will.
Yes.
Unless you're like in the desert or somewhere. But I think that was we have this idea that I need to be done with that. That I love the death by 1,000 paper cuts, because there's so many things that come up in this space. So maybe it's, you know, they say, hey, I'm done with church. And then maybe they decide they want to start drinking alcohol, or they decide they want a tattoo, or then you know, like in my case, I've got three kids, and all three kids, I was so worried that they were going to leave the church and that they would drink alcohol. And so it's just all of these that anticipating the grief.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's so fascinating. I spent so much time anticipating that grief, and some of those things have happened, and it's almost more, that anticipation is almost harder than the actual thing. Cause it's like, okay, this happened. I don't love it, but it's fascinating how much time I spent worrying about what was going to happen.
Yeah. And I think that's consistent. I think you're not alone in that. And for the women that I work with, it's a little bit different because, you know, for the most part, it's anticipating something in the future that they think will be awful, right? This is where it's similar. But really what they're anticipating that they think will be awful isn't so much the thing that will happen, the tattoo, the leaving the church. It's how we're going to feel
Yeah.
When that happens, which is why if we can get better at feelings, we feel less anxious, right? We anticipate it being less awful because we know, you know, if this is potentially going to happen and I were then to feel sad, you know, whatever the emotion is, and I also believe that I have the ability to allow sadness to flow through. I've shined the light under the bed and sadness is no longer, you know, a monster.
Yeah.
Then I'm more willing to do the thing, right? Or to have the conversation or to dread less that experience because I've just gotten better at feeling feelings. It's like, I think it's Pema Chodron who says, you know, the waves don't keep coming. We just get better at surfing the waves. Like we fall down less, we get up faster. We anticipate them more. We're better able to support ourselves. So we just get better, but the waves don't stop and they don't need to.
Yeah.
Because we're better at supporting ourselves.
Did you see the painting I have behind me in my office?
Oh, you're not until you moved. Is that what that's about?
Yeah. It's another wave of emotion. Our emotions, they are going to, you can't turn the ocean off. You may have little waves or you may have big waves that knock you over and pummel you to the ground, but we can, being able to handle those waves is a beautiful, not fun, but we know we can get through any of that.
Yeah. But it's so human, right? I mean, not all of being a human is fun, but that is what it is. And if like what I really hate to see is when there has been a loss and then because nobody ever taught us how to deal with the waves, right? We start hiding from them and we start limiting the choices that we make in our lives to avoid them.
Yes.
And then our lives get smaller and smaller and smaller. And maybe we get less intense, you know, waves, but also we get less of the good stuff. And I don't want that for any of us, you know? So yeah,
totally.
Can we just get better?
I see that a lot with my clients where they don't want to go to church anymore because they're scared they're going to be sad. They're going to get hit by a grief grenade at church. Mm-hmm. And this is something that they love. Their faith is an important part of them. But I see a lot of people just like, no, I don't want to cry at church. I don't want to be grieving there. And that's,
Yeah. And then maybe you do successfully avoid that experience, but also what else do you not get to experience?
Yeah.
What's the support you don't get to get? What are the moments of connection that now you miss out on? Yeah. You don't get to limit the ick and also not limit the stuff you want.
Yeah.
They come together.
Yes. Oh, that ick. I don't like the ick.
No, me either. But I'm better at it.
Yes. Yeah. We are all learning as we go. So a couple of things that I was thinking about, how do you know when you should talk to a coach or a therapist? I definitely have my take on that, but if someone was wondering, who should I be talking to right now?
I mean, I think it's interesting because over time, you know, I think it can sometimes just be semantics, right? Some therapists actually present themselves as coaches because they know what people, you know, some people want coaching. Like, so I think we want to hold those terms very lightly. And I think we want to consider more, instead of thinking about one term versus another, we're thinking about what is the kind of experience that I want, right? What would be most useful to me? So for me personally, immediately going back to, I had an amazing therapist who helped me through my divorce the first time. So I was back in her office really fast. And what that was really helpful for me to do was to just talk about it, to get it out, right? Because it intellectually made sense to me that it had happened, but also I was not in a place where it felt real, right?
Yeah.
My brain hadn't caught up yet. And so it felt very good to me to be able to talk to somebody about it and be super honest and not worry about them knowing me or them feeling bad or me trying to take care of them if You know, yeah. That's what happens with your friends is sometimes you're like, well, I'm telling you about how bad I feel. And then you feel bad. Now I got to take care of you because you feel bad about how I feel. And I just wanted somebody who was like neutral and I could just go and vomit on. And I didn't really want to change anything in that moment. I just wanted to be witnessed. Mm-hmm. And therapy was a great thing for me at that time. Then what I found, and again, everybody's experience varies, but what I found is that I got to a place where I kind of plateaued in what I was wanting. And what my therapist was telling me was, oh, you're doing so great. Right? You're doing great. And I get why she was saying that, but also what I really then needed and just happened, it was just like the perfect timing, right? I came out for air, like found myself in this kind of plateaued place, and then immediately found a coaching program that was perfect for me. And that was at the place where I was ready to start thinking about my thinking, right? In early acute grief, the grief fog was intense. I couldn't retain information. I couldn't read, you know, and process. Like it was, everything felt completely upside down. My hormones were out of whack. I wasn't sleeping well. You know, that is not the time where I would have been very well served by cognitive work.
Yeah.
Right. Now, if somebody could come in and could have taught me how to feel my feelings at that point in time or taught me how to tap, that would have been really powerful. Right. But definitely, I was not prepared to hear, you know, that thought you're having that your best days are behind you. Did you know that's a thought that you don't have to think if you don't want to? I was not in that place, right? Mm-mm. But then there was a place where that was very appropriate for me. And that's what I got from coaching. In fact, I don't know if I ever told you this, but I decided to become a therapist. Did I tell you that?
No, that's
so
awesome.
So my therapist was like, because listen, there is nothing that makes you question what you do for a living more than a huge loss that you did not expect, right? When you have a huge loss that you didn't expect and it just shakes you to the point where you go, okay, wait a minute. If life is this short and this precarious, am I doing what I want to do? What am I even doing here? Right. And that was the moment I had, because I worked for a Learjet and my husband was an engineer. He loved planes, obsessed with planes. It was his favorite thing. I was just there because it paid well. Really? I mean, I like the people, but it wasn't like a calling or anything. It paid well. And I was like, all right, this is not how I want to spend my time. I don't know what I want to do, but I want something that makes me feel like I'm doing something that's adding value to the world. So my therapist was like, you should become a therapist. Become a therapist. I'll help you get into an MFT program. And then when I'm ready to retire, you can buy my practice. I mean, she had it all planned out.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Right. I mean, why not? So I was literally in the process of, I had applied for an MFT program. I was waiting for it to start. I was taking an abnormal psych class because I didn't have that from undergrad, and waiting for that program to start. And at the same time, I discovered coaching and I started, I had such a different experience with coaching than what I had had with therapy that I just completely abandoned the idea of becoming a therapist. I was like, nope, forget it. It's coaching for me. That's what I want to do.
And that was all she wrote.
That's all she wrote. And will that be everyone else's experience? No, not necessarily. Yeah. Do a lot of therapists have the tools that I use as a coach? Probably. The most important thing is advocate for yourself. Recognize where you are and what would be helpful to you, and make sure that you don't stop looking until you find what you need. Right? Mm-hmm. And it's okay if it's not therapy, and it's okay if it's not coaching. But what do you need? And it's okay if it's therapy, but not with that therapist, or if it's coaching, but not with that coach, or if it's both.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we have to own that, and we have to advocate for ourselves. And most importantly, I think we have to decide that we're worth the quality of life that we want.
Mm.
And then we figure out the how. And we don't just go, well, I guess this is what it's like when your spouse leaves the church. I guess it's just always going to be this way. I guess this is the new normal that they talk about, with that tone of resignation that says, I don't get to have the human experience that I want to have because this awful thing happened to me. We don't quit there.
I love that. Yeah. And I think that's a big, that makes me think of, you have I've got all these different questions I want to ask you now. You're the person that introduced me to the concept of post-traumatic growth. And can you tell us a little bit about that and what that might look like in a mixed faith
Yes.
relationship?
Yes. I remember hearing post-traumatic growth and it was like a record scratch moment where you're like, wait, what did you say? What? You know, because
Did
everybody
you
knows
mean
about,
stress?
yeah, right. I know about post-traumatic stress disorder, but what's post-traumatic growth? So post-traumatic growth is a phrase that was coined in the mid-90s by a couple of researchers, Tedeschi and Calhoun were their last names. And they were noticing in some studies that, and some of their work was about widows actually, was that there was, for most people, an experience where they would have a particular level of wellness or quality of life before a trauma, and loss can be traumatic. And then after that loss, then their level of wellness or quality of life would dip down, and for some people would stay there, right? For other people, it would dip down, but then it would bounce back to where it was before the loss happened. But then there was this third group where it would dip down, but instead of just bouncing back, it would actually bounce forward. Those people are actually reporting higher levels of satisfaction with life, higher quality of life. And it wasn't in spite of what had happened, it was actually because of what had happened. It was because of what they had decided to do based on what had happened. And this to me was like mind-blowing because it really broke apart the story that was in my brain and felt so true to me about how it couldn't possibly be as good as it was going to be. It just couldn't be, right?
Yeah.
Couldn't be. And so then post-traumatic growth comes along and says, oh, but wait, actually, we aren't the ones that get to decide what happens to us, but we're always the ones that get to decide what we want to make of it, who we want to be in light of it. And I like to think about it like a tornado. I live in Kansas. We have tornadoes, so this is easy for me. But I like to think about it like a tornado comes and it knocks down your house, right? So this is like your spouse says, I'm leaving the church. You did not ask for that tornado to come, right? But it came. There it is. Now your house is leveled. So we got options. We're going to need to find some place to live. We could try and rebuild as close to that house as possible if we wanted to. We could try to get those original plans and give it back to the builder and like just build me the same house, right? Could try to do that. There would be nothing wrong with that. And also though, we've probably learned some things from having lived in that house, right? We're not the same person that we were when we moved into that house or built that house. We know some things. Okay, I want more light in this room. I want a different layout in this room. I want a bigger closet, like whatever it is, we know some things. We're more in touch with who we are and what we want than we were before. So why not then make choices accordingly? Why not then take that moment to check in and decide, what is it that I want? What do I really want? What would be so much more aligned with who I want to be and what I want to create and what I value? And can I then redesign with that in mind? Right? And that to me is post-traumatic growth. It's not saying that we wished for the tornado. It's not saying we're grateful that it happened. Right? It's saying it happened. And now who do I choose to be? What do I want to make of this given that it happened? Because that's the part nobody can take away from us. So I find it to be really empowering. And not as complicated as we want to make it mean, but it's like, all right, what do I value? It tends to happen in a few areas. So for definitely happens in faith, right? So a lot of us are going through the motions in our faith because it's what we grew up with. We didn't necessarily choose those beliefs. We just kind of inherited them. And this can be the opportunity, right? Where you really go, wait a minute. Okay, yes, this is what I have been believing. What do I want to choose for myself? Right. And so maybe you end up with a whole up-leveled sense of connection that you never even had before, because now you've chosen it for yourself. Now you're making conscious decisions about your faith. Same thing with relationships, right? Who are you spending your time with? Do you like who you're spending your time with? Are you being authentic in the way that you're spending time with people? Is this the quality of connection that you want to have? If not, this can be a real wake-up call to change that.
Yeah.
Right? Or careers. I mean, I don't even like to limit it to the dimensions that you would find if you read up on post-traumatic growth. I think it's just possible in all areas of life for us to always say, all right, this is what happened. What do I value? And how do I live even more into what I value?
Oh, I love that so much. And I think, people want to get to the other side of grief. They want to be, they want to be able to bounce forward or at least get to where they were before. And I love that image. I think that's so helpful. And I think that'll help a lot of people that are listening and realizing we do have the option of creating something that's even better.
Yeah.
I look at myself.
It doesn't have to be grand, by the way. It doesn't have to be like, sometimes I see people like, well, does that mean I have to now quit and I have to be a coach and I have to help other people whose, spouses have left the church? Like, do I have to then, is that what that? No, it's like, how in this moment that I am currently in, do I show up as more of the person I want to be? It's not like a greener pastures in the future kind of thing, although it can be, right? It can be creating massively big changes in your life. But it can also just be as simple as, how can I be an even fuller expression of who and what I value now?
Yeah. I love that.
Sorry, I cut you off earlier, but I get fired.
No, you're good. And looking at the things that I've learned as I've come through this experience, I feel like I have more empathy. I'm less judgmental. Just little things that are a big deal that I like who I am better now than I did before I started this experience. Did I want my house to be torn down with a tornado? No, thanks. And I am thankful for that. For those little nuggets of growth that have been happening along the way. Krista, I could ask you 10 million questions. I probably, is there anything, I'm just looking at time. I think we're probably getting near the end. Is there anything else that you want to share with us about any other little nuggets of goodness?
I don't want to make it more complicated. It already feels so complicated when we're going through it. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can just keep it simple for ourselves, like let's let ourselves feel how we feel. Let's normalize the experience, and also let's not give up on being who we want to be and creating what we want to create. If we could just do that, I think we would have such easier experiences.
I love that. Yeah. Well, and just, I love that. I love the NOW acronym. That's something that I use. But I say watch instead of witness, which are synonyms. So
there you go.
Good to have it. Well, just to be like, today's hard. This is, and I think there's so many little things that pop up, those little grief grenades. Like I know, now with my kids, I'm seeing their friends that are serving missions for our church. And every time I see one of those, it's like, oh yeah, I thought that was going to be my experience. I thought my son was going to be serving a mission and my daughter was going to be doing that. So when you're doing a water balloon toss, and when someone throws that water balloon to you, you want to grab it and kind of just let it land.
Yeah.
I think with those grief grenades that are coming our way, just to be like, yep, I got you, grief grenade. And just to hold on to that and let it land, because they're going to come. And we just want to be compassionate and be a soft landing place for those grief grenades when they come our way.
Yes. I think, if we could just get good at not dismissing our own experience.
Yeah.
Right. Treating ourselves like we would want to be treated, because you don't want to be told, well, what's your problem? They're still alive. Like, why is this such a big deal to you? Right. Which is basically a way of saying you shouldn't feel how you feel. And we do that to ourselves and we don't realize we're doing it. Oh, come on, get it together.
Yeah.
I should be further along than this for sure. Like, this should not be such a big deal. I should just count my blessings. We dismiss and minimize our own in pain in ways we would never intentionally do to other people. So like, what if we just stop doing that to ourselves?
It'd be so amazing.
Yeah.
And sometimes go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you'll teach them, Chris. You will help them with that.
One of my favorite things too, when I recognize that I'm feeling grief, is just to say, I see you, grief. Come on in.
Yeah.
Yep. You are here and you're welcome, opening up to it like you were talking about, instead of just like, nope, I can't handle this right now.
Yeah.
To let it come in. Oh, Krista, you are amazing. Thank you so much for sharing all your wisdom. And how can people find you if they want to learn more about what you're doing?
Yeah, I realized that my podcast, The Widowed Mom Podcast, sounds incredibly specific, and it is, but come listen, right? If you want to learn more about grief and how to support yourself or how to support other people, just definitely just listen and ignore the parts about being a widow. And if you have any widows in your life, send them my way. And if you want to connect anywhere else, go to coachingwithkrista.com, and that's where you'll find my email address and all my social stuff. You know, I always love hearing from people and what podcast interviews, you know, how they might have helped them, or if they have follow-on questions. That to me is the good stuff. So yeah.
Perfect. Thank you. I'm sure there are people that are listening that just would love to learn more. So well, you are just an angel, and I so appreciate the things I've learned from you over the years. And this has been just dreamy to be able to talk to you. And I'm glad we made it through the man walking past my window.
The weird guy by your window. That's just creepy.
I bet my gutters are really clean now, but I may have almost had a heart attack.
I so wish I could have seen that. You covered it so well. I didn't even notice anything had gone wrong. There was nothing that happened with your face. Apparently,
yeah, that was a fun. I was just like, oh dear, there is a person.
There is a human.
Well, Krista, thank you so much. And I just, for my listeners, thank you for being here. And hopefully there was some little things, just, and even you don't have to take it all in, just a couple, just one little nugget can help. Just let yourself feel that grief when it comes up. But I hope you guys have an amazing week, and that's all I've got for you today, and make a great week. Mwah! You don't have to be on the same page with religion to have a great relationship. If you are feeling stuck in all the emotions that are coming up for you in your mixed faith relationships, or are looking for tools to help you move forward, I can help you. Sign up for a free session with me. Go to chrisrichcoaching.com and click on work with me, because you and your loved ones are worth it, my friend.